It's a decent team. Deco was playing.
Deco?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant for us. Deco made his debut. Yeah. Sheriff Street, North Dublin.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast stream wherever you get your podcasts and download the OTB Sports app.
Thank you for joining us. So OTB Sports is back for another series of in-depth chats with some of the biggest names in Premier League and Irish football. With behind-the-scenes access, we're chatting to some of the legendary names from the biggest clubs and meeting the crucial people making behind the scenes who make Premier League club what it is. Now, it's all in association with Cadbury FC, their official global partner of Liverpool Football Club. And you can check out cadburyfc.com for updates on promotions and giveaways. Today's guest, it should be a really interesting chat. Somebody who has been involved on the pitch and very much behind the scenes as well. He was a young player coming through, hugely promising prospect. He did play for the first team. Two cruciate injuries more than played their part in halting his progress, unfortunately. He later returned to the club, though, as a physio and worked his way up to first team. And he was there from 2016 to 2020. I am, of course, talking about Richie Partridge. Richie, great to have you on the show. How are you doing?
All good, Joe. Thanks very much for having me. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Listen, I'm looking forward to the chat. You've had a really interesting career in so many ways. Grew up in Blanchardstown, Dublin. Skillful winger, home farm to Stella Maris. I think you probably realised pretty young that you were better than a lot of the lads who lived on the street next door to you.
Yeah, I mean, listen, as you say there, grew up just playing football. Minute you get in from school to the minute your ma's dragging you in for your dinner and then for your bath and bed. So, you know, yeah, it was originally my dad brought me to home farm. I think as a seven-year-old. From that, we had a decent team. And then we all sort of shifted over to Stella Maris and added one or two players. And really good, really interesting team. We won pretty much everything that was thrown in front of us. And I think nine of us in the end ended up getting a move over to England at 15 and 16. So it was really, really good team. But yeah, I think when you're growing up, you start to realise when the lads 2 and 3 years older, then you're starting to pull you in for their team and they want you on their side and you start to think, actually, yeah, I could be all right here. And I was one of those guys, you know.
Your Stella Maris team is an interesting case study in just how difficult it is to make it in the game. As you said, brilliant team. You know, one of these great teams that pop up in the DDSL routinely enough. 8-9 players go across to the UK. That's a huge number. I think in terms of names, we might recognise Keith Andrews would be the biggest name, really. Joe Murphy, I think, was involved as well. But other than that, you know, the many, many talented players that go over, it doesn't quite result in a lengthy, high-profile career. So Keith Andrews is the one with a bit of swagger from that Stella Maris team, is he?
Yeah, he's the standout in terms of he's gone over and he's had an unbelievable career. I think there's only myself, Joe, as you mentioned, and Keith who have actually went on to have careers in football who went over. But certainly Keith is the standout one. And he'll tell you he always was as well. But you know what he's like, not short of confidence.
Well, look, a man with hair that good is going to have a certain level of confidence, I think. Out of interest, would it have been apparent to you at 13, 14, was Keith the obvious candidate to make it or did he surprise you? I'm sure there were others that you thought were nailed on to make it.
Listen, at that age, the best player at 13, 14, 15 generally doesn't turn out to be the best player at 16, 17, 18 and then again at, you know, further on in their career. So I would have said Keith was probably one of the top five. He's your typical lad who's gone over to England and grown into being a footballer. I probably was the other way around. I probably went to England and then 15, 16, 17, 18 were probably my best years in terms of, you know, how I was as a footballer and how well I was thought of. Keith was the other way around. Keith definitely grew into being a professional footballer and all credit to him, you know, like a smashing lad and, you know, totally deserves it.
I know your parents were obviously huge influence on your career around that time. I hadn't realised your father passed away at just 41, heart attack. What age were you then, Richie?
I was 9, so I'm, funnily enough, I'm 41 now, so you sort of start to think like, oh, I still feel like I'm 19, to be honest with you sometimes. But that was quite an interesting one, quite a sad one really, because I was a 9-year-old. I was playing my first final for Stella Maris. So we were playing up in Balbriggan against Glebe North in, I think it was the Charlie Hockey Cup. I don't even know if that's still going. But yeah, we won 3-0. And then obviously, for obvious reasons, I'll never forget it. You know, word got round that some man, unfortunately, had collapsed in the clubhouse. And sure, unbeknownst to me, you know, it was my dad. And unfortunately, you know, he never pulled through. And it's funny, it's, you know, you see all the hype now, and rightly so, the incident that happened there in the Newcastle game, for example, where the man in the crowd unfortunately went into cardiac arrest, and everybody, you know, so aware of it and so understanding, you know, training throughout the population in terms of CPR and early defibrillation, you know, is key, and everybody is really aware. But, you know, you often think back then, people probably didn't really fully understand what was going on. And, you know, I suppose that there wasn't the education to probably help him at that point. So, yeah, it's an interesting one, sad one, obviously, you know, one you'll never forget for obvious reasons.
Turning 41 yourself at the age that he passed away, that is a prompt, I would think, for some kind of reflection, one, on just how young he was. And it's only when you reach certain ages you realise, God, I still feel so young. What a tragedy it must have been for your parents. Has it prompted you to revisit it a bit more this year? Have you found yourself thinking about it a bit more?
Well, funnily enough, actually, I was. I don't go home to Ireland too often, as you can imagine now, especially with COVID, and then obviously geographically where I am over in the Middle East. But we were over there, Qatar, were playing Ireland not so long ago there in the European qualifications, and I managed to get out of the hotel and see some family. My son came over from the UK, and my brother and my mum were there. And then we went up, we visited the grave, which would have been the first time I was able to do that in probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. So it certainly does. But as you mentioned, back then when you're 9, you think your ma and dad are ancient. You know, my ma was probably only 34 at the time, you know, my dad 41. But you as a 9-year-old, you know, your ma and dad are always like seen as a lot older. They're L1s and L1s, but really you look at it now and you think, you know, shouldn't have even been halfway through his life, you know.
So your mother has to pick up the pieces and she steps into the breach, and that includes trying to guide your football career.
Yeah, and let me tell you, not only for the football career, but what a job she did with the 3 kids she had. Credit to her, you know. Being modest, but we've all turned out all right, and all credit to her. So she did. She got herself a driver's license. She bought herself a little red Fiat Panda. I don't know how it made it across the back roads of Finglas every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday to play the games in Stella Maris. But yeah, she did, and she, you know, fair play to her. She threw her heart and soul into it, and in the end, you know, really grew to love it, and still does. Still loves football to this day, you know.
Fast forward a couple of years, you're 14 years of age and you're hot property. I know you're flying over to the UK to different clubs, and it's about 1996 when Steve Highway shows up at your house and says, right, come on, kid, Liverpool's the place for you. Were there any misgivings? Like, does your mother think, oh, Richie, education, can we stay a couple of years? Does any part of you, I suspect the 14-year-old you was quite happy to go, but does any part of you have misgivings about going over to Liverpool?
No, not at all. I mean, listen, I look now, and I've got a son who's 13, and you think, you know, in a year or two, if someone came and wanted him to move country, you know, he's a kid, you know, you think, how will he survive? But at the time, as you say, you don't really understand what you're getting yourself in for, really. You're going from school every day to having everything done for you to into the big bad world, I suppose. And although Liverpool look after you, and every club in England nowadays with their academies, they'll look after you, it's still a little bit just getting into the lion's den, if you like, and just seeing what the world actually has in store. But you don't really know. I'm sure my ma, you know, cried her heart out for the first week or so. But ultimately, it's a lad's dream. You'd never stand in the way of letting one of your children follow their dreams, regardless of how hard you think it'll be, you know.
How did you fit in then from a standard point of view with the other players?
So at that age, you know, as I said to you, sort of 15, 16, probably up to 19, 20, just after I got my first injury, you know, I don't mind saying that I was always playing age groups up. I was probably seen as the one in that specific age group. You had in the age group above me, you had Stevie Gerrard and Michael Owen. They were seen as the two in that age group. I was, you know, seen as the one in the age group below. And, you know, certainly, you know, I'd done more than fit in, and, you know, I probably could have gone to, you know, anywhere really in England, because they just want to take as many of the good talents at that age as they can. And you know, it's only as you grow older and then they start to filter out sort of lads who probably aren't quite good enough, that you realise then how hard it actually is, especially at a club like Liverpool, where they literally have the pick of Europe at that stage as well.
Yeah, because I know it's probably tricky for you to talk with any sense of humility and realism at the same time, because the sense I get from reading about you in advance of this interview is that you were very much the one in your age group, akin to how Michael Owen and Stevie Gerrard were the ones in their age group. And I saw a quote from Steve Staunton around this time when you were going really well, and he was talking to the Irish Independent. He said, "Richie's on fire. In a reserve game the other week, he absolutely destroyed the Bradford left back. He's quick as lightning, can cross, shoot, has a trick or two, catches out defenders. He's not far off the first team the way he's progressing. His size may hold him back a bit, but his pace makes up for that. Michael Owen isn't particularly big either, but his speed puts fear into defenders. It's the same with Richie. His feet are firmly on the ground. I don't think anything's going to stop him." Which is a hell of a quote in hindsight, isn't it? So, and like, Steve Staunton's not prone. You know, he's seen some players in his time. He's not prone to nonsensical hyperbole. You were obviously lighting it up at times. I don't know if you remember that Bradford game, for instance.
I don't particularly. I mean, listen.
Steve, it was just another left back. I just cut that one to ribbons as well. How can I remember them all?
And then I pulled me hammy and probably had to be taken off in the 70th minute. No, listen, Steve was great to me. When I went over, I think he joined for the second spell at the club and I was already there. So probably, I don't know, 97, 98 maybe. And he was great. You know, he took me under his wing a little bit because I had just moved up probably from the academy at that stage to the first team setup. And he was harsh with you during in training because he was a senior pro, being there, done it. I was, you know, looking at him thinking he's played X number of times for Ireland. He's played in World Cups, European Championships. You know, this is where I want to be. So, for him to say that was great. I can't remember the quote or I can't remember the game. But yeah, I mean, listen, at that time, again, I'm presuming I would have been 19, maybe 20, I don't know. And, you know, I was, you know, probably still at the point where if you'd have been given a chance or you'd have gone out on loan like I did, I suppose you can really crack on. And that's where I was. So, yeah, I think it's probably a fair comment. Listen, I did have my fair share of stinkers as well. Don't worry about that. But, you know, fair play. He's obviously spoke well of me.
So to progress then from underage to, as you said, training with the first team, that's starting to get very real and the dream is almost within touching distance. Can you remember as a player in your late teens what it was like training with that Liverpool first team, because they were a fairly glamorous bunch? I mean, I know they had the kind of Spice Boys thing thrown at them and all the rest, but there's just some amazing players, and you've got Michael Owen, and you've got Gerrard coming through, and it's a pretty exciting time, I think, at Anfield. I know they didn't quite win things the way they might have hoped to, that team, but that was a pretty cool team to be in training with. Any memories from that time?
Yeah, sure. I mean, listen, that was probably my favourite time of being involved in the first team as a player. As you mentioned, it was predominantly UK-based players. Gerard Houllier had just come in and started to filter in some European players, but they were all top lads. They were all really good lads, really good pros. And I suppose I'd had one injury. So I'd done my cruciate, I don't know, maybe 18 months previous to that. And to be fair, that was in and around the time when Gerard was coming into the club. And I remember Brian Kerr speaking to me because him and Gerard were very close. And I was obviously playing with the underage Ireland teams. And he was saying, listen, if you do well, Gerard said he's going to take you up to the first team squad. And lo and behold, then probably a month or two later, I got injured, ended up staying the rest of that season in the academy. Mm. But sorry, going back to your original question, I loved it. You know, you had the English books, you had the likes of Robbie Fowler, Jamie Redknapp, Steve McManaman was probably just coming to the tail end before he went to Madrid.
Yeah.
Michael Stevie. Then you had the likes of Stephen Wright, who was there, Alan Navarro, who were young lads a year above me. And I was probably, in and around that era, I was probably as close to playing more regularly then than I was at any other stage, I would say. So thoroughly enjoyed it. And yeah, of course, the crack in the changing rooms and everything that goes with it was brilliant as well. And as a young lad, just being brought into that setup and being accepted as well, because, you know, I've seen it go the other way where lads have come in, you know, acted a little bit big time Charlie, and these lads would shut them down in an instant. So it was good. It was really good. And as you say, a great team, probably underachieved actually, if anything.
Yeah. So that's amazing. I mean, if you're holding your own with that quality of player, that shows where you were. Is it the second injury when you're 22, the second cruciate? I don't know, was it the same cruciate or the other leg? Is that the one where you felt you might have lost a yard of pace here or there, which obviously for your game was pretty much crucial?
100%, yeah. So it was the other leg. So basically, I done my left when I was 17, 18.
Yeah.
Got through that fine. Rehab went really well. I was a kid, you know, I didn't really understand injuries. I didn't understand what was going on. Someone just told me I'd be out for 6 months. So I dealt with it, was out for 6 months and was back to, you know, as good as I was really. So that didn't hold me back. I then subsequently made the move to Melwood, had a decent loan spell, made my debut, went to Coventry then and probably played the best football in my career when I was on loan there.
You should say for people, you went to Coventry, now championship level, player of the season with the fans age 21. So that's, you know, that's another kind of box ticked. I can hold it at that level.
Yeah, and listen, that was, you talk about time, and I suppose, listen, everybody gets injuries in football, some big, some small.
Mm.
Obviously, I had a couple of big injuries, but it was more for me the timing. So I just come back from Coventry. I think they put a bid in and Reading put a bid in who they'd either just been promoted or they were going to be promoted that season. And Liverpool hung on to me, you know, said, no, give me another contract. And then in the September of that season, I went and done my right, cruciate ligament injury in a reserve game. And you're dead right. Listen, when I came back from the first one, I was flying. I was still probably 10 stone three, wet through, you know, still quick, still had me sharpness. And probably what I didn't realise and what you sort of realise the older you get and also now the profession I'm in, I was always told, you know, you're small, you probably need to get a bit stronger. So I absolutely threw myself into the big gym programme, but, you know, I couldn't really do much leg strength. So it was all upper body work and every day, and I started to get a little bit hooked on it. And all of a sudden, you know, you see your chest starting to grow and your arms starting to grow and okay, it might look all right when you're on holidays, but I remember coming back in my first game back thinking to myself, my goodness, like I just can't seem to get my second wind and I can't seem to get that sharpness. You know, you know what you'd want to do and what you'd be able to do previously.
Mm.
And it's only when you look back, I must have put on about 3/4 of a stone and it was all upper body muscle, whereas my lower half, where you need your strength and you need the bulk, was gone because of the injuries. And I ended up having surgery again after that on the right side. So I was out for about 10 or 11 months altogether. So that rehab didn't go well at all.
Right.
But it's only the older you get, you realise. And you look now, for example, to the best players in the world, you look at the likes of Mo Salah and you look at Cristiano Ronaldo and they score, they take the top off and there's more meat in a butcher's apron, you know. That's the way forward, you know. Whereas back then, there probably wasn't the science, there probably wasn't the education. And I literally put on the guts of a stone and it was all upper body, you know, upper body muscle and probably a little bit of fat as well.
Those years, so you ultimately will leave the club in 2005. Those years where you're coming back from this second cruciate and you've put on your muscle and something's not quite right and you can probably sense you're not quite yourself, A lot of those years, I presume, then are in the reserve team and probably going to matches at Anfield in your suit. Is that a terribly unenjoyable, frustrating time? Is it okay because you're still, again, sort of around this huge club and it's iconic and you're, you know, you're kind of hoping things come right? Do you remember what that period is like? Like, for instance, what's the match day experience in your suit like?
Yeah, it's at that age, because, I was 24. And you look at lads now at that age, if they're at a big club, they're playing every week. They're in their peak or hitting their peak. And I was literally the other way. So, as I mentioned to you before, 19, 20, 21, before the second injury, was my best spell at the club. And then to go into the period where you're not even being considered for squads, you're playing reserve team football, and you know you're not doing yourself justice because you're not really at the level you were at, then it's bittersweet, because you want the lads to do well on a Saturday in the league and ultimately in the Champions League because they're your mates. But then you know you need to kick on even more if you want to get anywhere near that level. And to go there and not be involved, or, as you say, just go in your suit, watch the game and the lads win, and the next day you've got training with the subs and the other reserve team players, and know, especially the last year, know that you're not being considered for a game. It's not good. And then the ironic thing about that as well is you look to go out on loan, and then you'd get a loan move, sort of teed up, and then you'd get injured, And I suffered a lot with soft tissue injuries as well in those years, and probably later in my career too. So then you're putting it back, another month or two, see how you go. I ended up having another knee operation on the left side when I was 23. So, that in terms of timing wasn't great. And it's not nice. It's not enjoyable. And the one thing I found was tough as well, you'd be phoning lads, your mum back home, and, you'd be speaking to them. And whereas I'd always have been used to say, I've been called up to the first team squad job, I might be on the bench or whatever. It was literally like that just gone at that point. And disappointing. And I probably dealt with it really well. Nobody probably knew, at the time that it was horrendous, because you're smiling, you're getting on with your job, you don't say the wrong things, you don't go banging on the manager's door. But yeah, it's hard. And any footballer that tells you differently, they wouldn't be telling the truth,
No, it sounds like you dealt with it amazingly well. Like, that would be a time to just hit the pubs and drink yourself silly and feel sorry for yourself and to give out of the world. Was it tough? Like, I don't know how close you were to, say, Stephen Gerrard. Obviously, I know Michael Owen is brother-in-law, so there's a relationship there, or any of the other players in the first team. Was it hard across those years, and then maybe even beyond, after you leave the club, almost to be around them, to kind of even have a smell of Anfield or to see Anfield on the TV? And privately, because I don't think you can go around telling everyone, well, I could have been this, I could have been a contender. You don't want to be that person. But privately, you would know how good you were, and a bit of luck in life, who knows what might have happened. Was it difficult, say, for those subsequent 10 years to either be chatting away to Michael or come into contact with Stevie Gerrard or any of the other players who make it, or even when Anfield comes up on the TV? What was that like for you?
No, that was fine. Once I left, it was like, chapter closed, okay. No problem. I was at the stage in my career where I knew I certainly wasn't going to go and play for Liverpool or Man United or any of those big teams. But it was a case of where I was going to end up and the level I could get myself to. So no, it was fine. It was absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. And for the rest of my playing career, it was, it's no problem, I suppose. It's just when you reflect, when you retire and you look back, and I suppose you see, especially when I went back to Liverpool working in the academy as a physio to start off, and you see other lads who are probably in similar positions, you just want to tell them to absolutely throw their heart and soul into it, because I suppose a lot of players will be in the same position as me, where they look back and they think, I could have done this, I could have done this, I could have done this, and maybe things would have been different. Maybe they wouldn't, but maybe they would. So there's no bitterness, or there was never any bitterness at all, especially towards Liverpool. It was a case of, as I say, chapter closed, move on, and they're trying to scrap and get myself another club.
Richie, I do want to talk to you about the physio career, because, you know, it's been an incredible journey in its own right. But just to put a full stop on the rest of your playing career, you retired age 30. Quite a few clubs in that period after you left Liverpool: Sheffield Wednesday, Rotherham, Chester, MK Dons, a loan spell at Kettering Town, Stockport, and then finally I think you ended up in Wales at the New Saints.
Jumping
around a lot, I suspect never quite getting to the level you wanted to get to. How was that for you? What was that period of your life like?
Yeah, difficult, you know, because, I mean, I'd started my physio training when I left Liverpool, so I did have something else going on in the background which kept me sort of safe in the knowledge that I need to really plough through these last few years of my career, you know, make a living, make sure I'm getting paid every month, enjoy it as best I can. But it was tough. I mean, I remember, I think I'd left Chester. It was just before I went to MK Dons, actually. Paul Ince took me down there on trial and then signed me for a year. But I was scrapping around and, you know, lads will tell you, when you're in that rat race at the end of the season when thousands of lads are getting released and they're all looking for clubs and managers are probably getting phone calls left, right and centre, it's difficult. You know, it's a difficult place to be in. But I remember I spoke to the Hereford manager at the time, it was, I can't recall his name. And I met him in a service station somewhere between Chester and Hereford. And we're chatting away and he's like, he's looking at me sort of resume and saying, you know, you've not really played consistently. You know, you've played 20 games here. You've played 30 games here. Oh, you've only played 6 games this season. You know, why is that? And I'm sort of half trying to pull the wool over his eyes and say, listen, you know, I fell out with the manager, or, you know, a club came in and the manager didn't want me to go, when really it was either I was injured or the manager just probably didn't fancy me at the time. Mm. And, he's gone to me, he said, I remember you maybe 2 or 3 years ago. You were quick, maybe even before that. And he's still quick. And I was like, yeah, you know, of course I am. I'm 29, probably limping out of the car. He's probably seen me. And he's gone, would you race me in the car park? And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, what's going on here? So, of course, I come back down. So there's me and him in this car park in a service station in the middle of nowhere. And people must have been looking at him, what's going on? He was probably late 50s. So he said, I'm getting a 10-yard head start. So I'm literally cutting corners behind him and everything, trying to catch up. But he offered me a contract in the end, but I ended up going to MK Dons. So I must have pulled the wool over his eyes.
Oh my God. That is a long way from
crazy.
That's a long way from hanging out with Stevie G at Melwood.
Exactly. So that'll tell you how hard it is, and what it's like at that level. You know, when you're knocking around League One, League Two, dipping into the Conference. You know, it's not easy.
Fascinating to hear about the life of a physio at a Premier League club. So, as you said, you use a lot of your 20s very wisely and get your qualifications. You return to Liverpool. You work with some of the underage teams, and then 2016, it's the big time. It's the first team, and you spend 4 years there. And lest anyone need reminding, they're 4 pretty good years. Things work out, there's some trophies won, and it's an amazing batch of players. So, for instance, I would think in comparison, say, with late 90s, the analysis that's done on players day to day is night and day. How closely are the players monitored, say, on a daily basis in the first team, Richie?
It's everything, really. So, from the minute they walk in, they'll get what we call their subjectives done, so how they slept, the quality of their sleep, how many hours they slept, how they're feeling, their muscle fatigue, muscle soreness. And if it's day after games, they'll get some objective measures with them as well. So certain movements in their ankle and movements in the groin, which are sort of predictors of injury. So these are done on a daily basis every morning or when they come in. So it might be an afternoon session. Mm. So they're monitored then. They obviously have everything prepared for them food-wise. And that is literally from the moment they walk in to the point where they get a bag handed to them on their way out, to the point where they then have their own chefs through the club go to their houses and cook them any meals or snacks that they want as well. So that's all covered. And then they're actually monitored on the training pitch as well through GPS. So, it's unfortunate, really, that they're monitored when they go out and about through social media too. So that's the downside. But now, from a performance point of view, and listen, you know, this won't be just Liverpool. This will be across the board, at international level, everything.
And if a player comes in and there's a tightness in their groin or lack of flexibility, say, in their ankle, is it, well, okay, you're not training today, we'll get you checked out and we'll try and preempt injury. So that's the point of that, I would presume.
It is, but again, it's very individual. Right. So you'll get to know players, and if they've had a significant injury history, for example, they'll then be looked after. So yeah, they've flagged up with a certain test, they've got a significant injury history in this area, sure, you know, we'll look after them. Then you'll get the other lads who, they're okay, this is flagged up once, so okay, we'll monitor, we'll let you go, we'll let you train, but if it flags up two or three times, we'll pull you, or we'll certainly have a look a little bit more in depth.
Okay.
And then, of course, it depends on the stage of the week you're at or the stage of the season. So if you've got a game in 5 days' time and this training session isn't too key, well, then the manager will certainly just turn around and say, yeah, give him a rest. But if it's the day before a game and he needs him out there for some tactics or whatever, well, then it's different. We'll just manage and monitor. Mm. You know, that's generally how it's done.
And is it at a stage now where that food that you mentioned, is that all individually tailored to each player? Or are they all getting the same bag of food?
No, again, it depends on the boys who are unfortunate, who are carrying a little bit too much, or are just genetically that way, whereas you have the other lads who can pretty much eat near of what they want and they'll still keep the body weight down.
Who are the lucky ones? Who are the lucky ones at Liverpool that can eat what they want?
So, I mean, listen, the majority of them, you look at the likes of Sadio, the likes of Adam Lallana when I was there, was, you know, outrageously, you know, in good shape. He had his injury issues, all right, but them two, Mo was, you know, blessed as well. You know, you'd see him eat 5-6 meals a day, and you know, you still look at the shape he's in now.
Yeah.
But again, you know, they look after themselves in other ways. They look after themselves in every way, you know, and that's the big difference between now this batch of players and I suppose the batch of players that I first went into as a player.
Yeah, I'll bet, because it is extraordinary. I want to ask you your sense of it, because it's not so much that we're seeing the great players of the world peak earlier, like Ronaldo, Messi, Lewandowski, Zlatan. They're all exceptional in their mid-20s, but the longevity is now off the charts. I mean, 32, 33, 34 is now young-ish, whereas obviously for your generation, you know, anyone reliant on any physical attributes, once they hit 30, it was the clock is ticking. So is that the major development? They're just looking after themselves better. And we're going to see that now across the board going forward, I would think. Like, will 40 become the new 35, do you think?
Well, listen, I mean, Giggsy went into his 40s, didn't he? I mean, he's probably a one-off.
Yeah.
You get the odd goalkeeper doing it as well. I've seen actually John Murphy has just signed for Tranmere, so he's another one. He'll be 40 now.
Right.
But no, it's a mixture. It's a mixture of education. It's a mixture of the players looking after themselves. And it's science as well. Science has come on in leaps and bounds. Clubs, as you say now, and international setups have got probably, I would say, between 4 and 5 times the amount of staff now as they did when I first came into the game.
Right.
And it's working, you know, it's working. The players are getting, you know, from a physio point of view, the players are getting treatment whenever they want. They're getting looked after 24 hours a day if they want. They also are educated and they're told and it's drilled into them the right things to do, the wrong things to do. You know, the diet, you know, is key, you know, in terms of the performance. So it's a mixture. And you know, it's difficult to actually see where it'll go from here.
Yeah.
Because I think it's at a level now where it's very impressive throughout football, really is.
And so, like, traditionally, and I suppose it is changing, but traditionally some players would have been injury prone. Like Richie Partridge, well, he's just injury prone, I suppose, would have been a thing that said. There's probably something in that. Is there, like, are there certain players, say, at Liverpool, you might have an example or two, who are just naturally durable? Whatever way the mechanics of their body are set, they have flexibility in the right places, it doesn't put pressure on certain muscle groups, and they are just naturally durable. Like, are there certain players like that at Liverpool who would just, even 20 years ago, would play every game almost?
Of course. I mean, you hear Jamie Carragher now. He talks about the likes of lads who had muscle injuries, and he'd never believe them. You know, someone had stiff hammy, pulled me hammy, I'm out for 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And he point blank wouldn't believe them because he's never had a muscle injury. He's played for probably played the best part of 20 years at a decent level and never had a muscle injury.
Wow.
Now, it's not because he's played, you know, less games. It's not because, you know, he's played less minutes or he didn't put enough in training. He was one of the best trainers you've come across. He was one of the most, you know, outstanding defenders the club has ever seen. And so 100% muscle architecture, and as you say, durability plays a big key. And that's down to genetics. It's just down to how your body functions, how you are made up. And it's nothing, it's the way you were born. So that's definitely an element of it. Another element, which is a massive element, which is really, really done well now, is load monitoring. So we know through science that if you do a big spike in games or a big spike in training, you're more injury prone.
Yes.
Whereas years ago, lads would go away for 6 weeks in the off season, not do a thing. They'd come back, they'd run, and lo and behold, you'd have six or seven of them pulling up with muscle injury. So that's just in its simplest form, by the way. But definitely what you say is true.
Because I always remember Alex Ferguson in one of his books, and you would have worked with Jordan Henderson, for instance. So Ferguson was talking in his book about how he was very keen to sign Henderson, loved him as a player, spoke to Steve Bruce. He said, Bruce said, listen, great guy, smashing person, you should sign him. Ferguson said in his book, then our medical department said they weren't happy with his running style. He could be the type to have injuries, was what Ferguson said, which is really interesting. So were Ferguson's medical team correct? Like, is there something off with his gait or his running style? And if so, did you do something to change it? Or were Ferguson's medical team maybe worried about nothing?
Listen, I'm a big believer. If you run in a certain way, that's how you run. If you try and change a sprinter's running mechanics, fair play, you might knock 0.2 of a second off his time. If you try and mess around with a footballer's mechanics, you're asking for trouble, because his body, any footballer's body, who I had the worst running style going, you know.
Right.
But if you try and change that, your body has adapted to that running style over the course of whatever age you are, 10, 20, 30, and your body is the best coping mechanism with that running style. If you then try and manufacture what you perceive as the correct running style, well, then you're asking trouble.
Right.
You can only try and change, in my opinion, if you're running in a straight line. Now, footballers don't run in straight lines.
Yeah, okay.
You know, they do anything but. And I would imagine, if you look at the statistics now, I don't know how many games Jordan Henderson has played since that.
He's done okay.
Quote. Yeah, he's done all right. He's done all right. And you know, and I tell you, not a better professional you'll come across either. Yeah. Like, top pro, really top pro, and a great captain, fair play.
Yeah. And so you talked there about the load, heavy load, meaning players more susceptible to injury. So I guess the red zone is maybe how it's talked about more commonly in the media, for instance. It would strike me that for a lot of when Liverpool were really, you know, that Champions League season into the Premier League winning season, I mean, a lot of the same faces playing a lot of the same games and seemed to be fit enough to do it. How was Jurgen Klopp when it came to sports science, i.e. Jurgen, Salah and Mane are both in the red zone? I know it's Real Madrid tomorrow, but you might want to think about that. Was he engaged with the sports science? I would suspect he would have had to be, one, because he seems very cerebral in that front and listens to experts, and also because I guess he would be smart enough to know, well, if I lose them for five games, it's a lot worse than losing them for one. So that relationship with Klopp and trying to manage players' loads, what was that like?
Well, firstly, what you do is you just don't have that conversation. You just cross your fingers and hope for the best in the game. No, I'm kidding. Listen, he was fantastic.
Right.
He has a degree in sports science, I'm sure. I read, he never used to allude to it, but I think I read it somewhere.
Wow.
But listen, he's a football man. He's an experienced manager. He understands in football, it's not black and it's not white. You have your statistics. You have your feelings on a player. The player will have their own thoughts. The manager will have his own thoughts. And it's a collective decision. And, you know, again, it would boil down to risk view reward. And for sure, you know, if you told them that two of them were struggling before a big game, one of them or two of them are definitely playing,
right.
You know, and that's just how it is.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, this is this game. If anything happens, we'll deal with the next game when it comes. If it's a more, I suppose, like a diagnosed injury, so clinically it looks like he's got a small injury, he goes for a scan, radiologically he has a small injury, okay, it's a bit different. But when it's just down to that little grey area of, okay, listen, it's a bit of a risk, but, you know, he might get away with it, but this is the risk. Well, then, you know, ultimately it's his decision. And let's be honest, he's done all right from making those decisions over the course of the last, I don't know, many years he's been a manager, 30 years, 25 years. And so we'll give him the information, but he's the most experienced in terms of making those decisions, if that makes sense.
And Richie, I presume, like, it just goes with the territory that you, as a footballer, quite often have to play through the pain barrier. So on a given Saturday, as 11 Liverpool players are walking out in the tunnel, what percentage of them, if you were to stop them and say, how are you feeling, what percentage of the 11 midway through a season would say, yeah, I'm 100%, I feel great?
Nah, they'd be lying, because, you know, to play that amount of games and not to have any type of anything, from muscle soreness, fatigue, to having slept bad the night before, to having an ongoing chronic issue. You know, none of them, you'd only ever get some of them saying that in pre-season when we first come back. And that's literally football down to a T, because you never, you know, I can say personally, you never go out into a game feeling 100%. There's always something going on. It's just how big of a deal that is.
I suspect you've probably watched games where the media are saying, well, X, he was a bit quiet today, and actually X has performed a miracle to get through the 90 minutes.
Yeah, listen, this is the beauty of football. You don't have a magic ball. You only use your experience and what you know in terms of your education and what you've seen in the past, and for me, what I've witnessed and gone through as a player. It's only best guess. But ultimately, I've seen lads go out there where you're thinking 100% he's coming off after 20 minutes maximum, and he's lasted 90 minutes and he's played the next game and the next game.
Right.
And vice versa, you think absolutely this lad feels fine, and then after 5 minutes, nah, I need to come off. And so this is where all the science plays a massive part, but ultimately it's not the be all and end all. Yes. You know,
there's a human, quality to it, I suppose, as well, yeah. And are there any, I won't ask you for the unfair one, as in the lad who comes off after 20 minutes when you think he'd be fine, but were there any players who surprised you with their ability to get through games?
Listen, the big one I can think of at Liverpool was James Milner. He's obviously 34 now. When I left, he was maybe 32. Played hundreds of Premier League games. A fantastic professional, to the point where he'd probably report things that other lads wouldn't, because he's got an understanding and an education through football that he knows he's probably got a bit of an issue. I need to tell the physios, because they might be able to help. And ultimately goes out, plays 90 minutes, comes back in, and more often than not, he's like saying, yeah, listen, I felt it through the whole game, but I've got through it, and we'll play the next game as well. He would be probably the standout one, you know.
Yeah, you might have come through similar-ish time to him. Is it nice being on a level with some of them? Like, they're like, he played. Do you get a bit more respect, do you think?
Well, I remember, it was hilarious. I remember I first went up to the first team, and England had I don't know if it was a World Cup or Euro, so it would have been, what, 2014? So was that Euros? Maybe
14 was the World Cup in Brazil.
So we've gone away on pre-season, and the English lads who've just been away, they were coming to meet us. So they missed the first week in Melwood, and they were coming to meet us. So I'd only pass by a few of the first team lads when we'd come up from the academy, you know, once a month. So then I was obviously first team physio, and I remember Milner and Henderson coming in, and it was the first time we'd met them, and, you know, shaking the hand, you know, how are you? I'm Richie, pleased to meet you. And he's like, I used to sign you for a Championship manager every season, he said to me. So he says, you were the next up and coming thing, you used to win me all games about 2 or 3 years after I'd signed you. So that was a good icebreaker. But I may have played a reserve team game against him as well, because he would have being in the reserves at 16, and then I would have still been knocking around the reserves at, like, I don't know, 23 and 24, I suppose, ultimately, at Liverpool.
Yeah. I guess the last one, I mean, it's amazing football has given you this livelihood in an unexpected way, I suppose.
Yeah.
Is it enjoyable or is it relentless being a physio? Do you feel like, do you get that sense of camaraderie back and part of a team, or is it that bit different? What's the experience been like, say those 4 years with that Liverpool first team, for instance?
Yeah, it's great. Listen, I've never not worked in football since I was 15. You know, I'm blessed and really lucky. It's the only sort of environment I know since I've been an adult. So coming in and working, especially, you know, back as a physio at the likes of Liverpool, it's every, your first day in uni to study physio, it's your dream job, basically. If someone says to you, in 5 years' time, you're going to be at Liverpool, in 8 years' time, you're going to be with the first team, you know, it's dream job. So being involved and having that, you know, regardless of my background is amazing. But then with my background, knowing how change rooms work, knowing how treatment rooms work, I sort of had to pull myself back a little bit from the player or the ex-player in me at times as well. But I think the lads, you know, there and where I am now, fully respect that, and they know that, okay, I may have been in the first team at Liverpool for whatever, 4 years, but, you know, I've been a professional footballer for 14 years previous to that. So it does help, and it gives you, and I think it gains you a little bit more respect at the beginning, but then you do ultimately have to earn that respect in terms of what you do and what you know as physio.
Yeah, I'm sure. And look, you've done remarkably well, because Liverpool first team, that's serious stuff. It's not charity. It's not former player stuff there. You need to be on top of your brief or you'd be quickly moved on. And so it's Qatar now, big decision to leave, big wrench to leave Liverpool behind, or how did that all come about?
Massive, yeah. Listen, very tough. Toughest decision of my career. Listen, I loved it at Liverpool, and if this opportunity hadn't come up, I'm sure I'd still be happy as Larry in that job. But this opportunity did come up. I was 39 at the time, and I thought to myself, right, if I don't take this job now, the chances are I'll probably never take a job abroad again. There was the lure, obviously, of the World Cup, and to ultimately work in the build-up to a World Cup and to work at a World Cup. And as well, you know, I've been in club football for, 25 years. So I thought, right, to tick the international box as well. I actually always thought if I was ever going to do that would be with Ireland, but to tick the international box as well was fantastic. And to move my wife and the two young kids as well out here and give them the experience and the lifestyle out here as well has been fantastic. So no regrets, but yeah, a big decision, sure.
Okay. Well, listen, I have to say, what an amazing career, very different, and seems to be going great for you. Delighted to hear that. So, Richie Partridge, absolute pleasure. And best of luck over the next, big 15 months coming up.
Cheers, Joe. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. That is Richie Partridge there. Great to chat to him. The show was in association with Cadbury FC, official global partners of Liverpool Football Club. You can check out cadburyfc.com for updates on promotions and giveaways.